All right, so today we're going to unpack this Hawaiian property law case,
Okay.
Fong v. Hashimoto.
All right.
We're talking ocean views, neighborly disputes, and a deed restriction that isn't as straightforward as it seems.
Yeah, it's really fascinating how this seemingly simple restriction, like one story in height, just completely unravels when you start looking at it with legal scrutiny.
Right.
We're going to see how ambiguity and the timing of property sales
Yeah.
and something called a grantor's interest all played crucial roles in the court's decision.
Definitely, you want to pay close attention to how the original property was divided because that becomes a key factor in this case.
Absolutely.
So we've got the court opinions, legal analyses, and some practical takeaways that are relevant whether you're a seasoned lawyer or just starting law school.
Yeah, this case actually went all the way up to the Hawaii Supreme Court, so we know the stakes were high.
Oh, wow.
Get ready to dive into the fascinating world of property law, Hawaiian style.
All right, so picture a gorgeous piece of oceanfront property in Hawaii, subdivided into 15 lots. Some have those million-dollar ocean views, others are nestled into the mountainside.
Right. The original owner, Edward Fogarty, starts selling off these lots, and that's where our main players come in. The Fongs, who buy lots 4 and 5, and later the Hashimoto's purchase lot 11.
Got it.
Now, the Hashimoto's have this deed restriction limiting them to building a one-story house.
Okay, sounds pretty clear-cut.
Right. But here's the catch.
Uh-oh.
Only 3 out of the 15 lots have this restriction.
Okay, so that's where the conflict comes in.
Exactly.
So the Hashimoto's want to build this two-story dream home.
Of course.
But the Fongs, whose lots are up on the mountainside, sue to block them,
Right.
claiming their view is at stake.
Yeah, makes sense.
Now, wait a minute. If only three lots have this restriction,
Yeah.
why do the Fongs think they have any say in what happens on the Hashimoto's lot? Was
Yeah.
there even like an overall plan for the whole development?
That's a great question, and it gets to the heart of what's called an equitable servitude. For a restriction to be enforceable as an equitable servitude, it needs to be part of a clear, consistent plan for the entire subdivision, a common scheme, as it's called in legal terms.
Okay, so if all the lots were meant to have this height restriction,
Yeah.
things might have played out differently.
Exactly. The court in this case found that restricting only 3 lots didn't demonstrate such a common scheme.
Okay.
It looked more like individual agreements between Fogarty and those specific buyers
Right.
rather than a comprehensive plan governing the entire development.
Got it. Okay, let's break down the legal reasoning the court used.
Oh, okay.
They relied on three main principles, right?
Yes.
Ambiguity, common scheme, and something called the grantor's interest.
You got it, and they're all interconnected in this legal puzzle.
Okay.
Let's start with ambiguity. The court actually found the restriction one story in height to be ambiguous.
Right.
It could be open to multiple interpretations.
Hold on, how can one story be ambiguous?
Right.
Doesn't that seem pretty straightforward?
Well, the court pointed out that the restriction doesn't specify whether it refers only to the height of the walls or the overall height, including the roof.
Oh.
What about square footage or building materials? Could you have a massive one-story structure that still blocks the view?
Right.
That lack of precision is what the court considered ambiguous.
So even seemingly simple language can have hidden complexities.
Exactly.
Wow, this is making me think twice about all those like maximum height signs I see around town.
It definitely highlights why clear and precise wording is crucial in legal documents, especially when it comes to property rights. You want to avoid any room for interpretation that could lead to disputes down the line.
Yeah, for sure. All right, that makes sense.
Okay.
So ambiguity was a strike against the Fongs.
Yeah.
What about the common scheme requirement? We
Right.
touched on that earlier.
Right. For a restriction to stick as an equitable servitude, it can't just be a random, isolated thing. There needs to be evidence of a common plan, a scheme that applies consistently across the entire development. Think of it like zoning regulations. They apply to everyone within a specific zone.
And in Fong v. Hashimoto, only 3 out of 15 lots had the restriction. So the court didn't see that consistency.
Precisely. The court emphasized that there was no indication Fogarty intended a uniform one-story height limit for the entire subdivision. The sporadic nature of the restrictions made them unenforceable as equitable servitudes.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting for me. Remember how we mentioned that Fogarty sold lots 4 and 5 to the Fongs before selling lot 11 with the restriction to the Hashimoto's?
Ah, you're picking up on a critical detail. That order of events plays a huge role in the next legal principle, the grantor's interest.
Okay, I'm all ears. Why is the timing of those sales so important?
Legally, a grantor can't create a covenant that benefits land they no longer own. It's like trying to give away something you don't possess anymore. By the time Fogarty put that one-story restriction on the Hashimoto's deed, he had already sold the Fong's lots. He no longer had a legal interest in their property.
So even if the restriction wasn't ambiguous and there was a clear common scheme, the Fong still couldn't enforce it, simply because of when Fogarty sold their lot.
Exactly. The court was very clear on this point, stating that Fogarty did not have a sufficient interest in the benefited lots when creating the burden. It's a fundamental principle of property law. You can't burden someone else's property for the benefit of land you no longer own.
It's like he was trying to control something he had no right to control anymore.
That's wild.
Precisely. And the court really hammered that point home. It's fascinating how something as seemingly mundane as the order of property sales can completely derail a legal argument.
Yeah, this case is like a goldmine of legal lessons. It really shows how these seemingly straightforward property issues can get so complicated when you dig into the nuances of the law. Absolutely. And it highlights how crucial careful drafting is and really understanding these legal concepts inside and out. Even a tiny detail, like the order those properties were sold, can have massive consequences.
Yeah. All right. So we've covered ambiguity and common scheme.
Right.
Two strikes against the Fongs.
Mm.
But we're not done with this grantor's interest yet, are we?
Right.
There's more to this principle.
All right. There's another layer we need to peel back, and it involves this concept called privity.
Okay.
But before we get into that, let's take a step back and define what an equitable servitude is for our listener who might not be familiar with the term.
Yeah, I think a little refresher would be helpful.
Okay, so think of it like this.
Okay.
Imagine a neighborhood where everyone agrees to certain rules, like no parking on the grass or keeping their fences a certain height.
Right.
These agreements, when attached to the property itself, are kind of like invisible threads connecting all the homeowners.
So it's more than just a friendly agreement. It actually has legal weight and affects how they can use their property.
Exactly. An equitable servitude is a restriction on land use that's enforceable in a court of equity.
Okay.
It's a way to make sure those invisible threads have real legal teeth. And it ensures those restrictions stay with the property, even if it's sold to someone new.
So in this case, the Fongs were arguing that the one-story restriction was one of those invisible threads?
Yes.
An equitable servitude they could enforce against the Hashimoto's?
Exactly. They were claiming that Fogarty intended that restriction to benefit their lots and protect their view, even though it wasn't explicitly written in their own deeds.
Right.
But as we've seen, the ambiguity of the restriction, the lack of a common scheme, and the whole issue with the grantor's interest all combined to create a pretty solid wall against their argument.
Man, this case has so many twists and turns. And you mentioned earlier that even among the judges, there wasn't complete agreement on every point.
That's right. One of the judges, Justice Nakayama, actually disagreed with the majority's opinion that the one-story restriction was ambiguous. He thought the restriction was clear enough to be enforceable.
Wow. So even the legal experts could see this case from different angles.
Exactly.
That's fascinating. So if he didn't think it was ambiguous, why did he ultimately rule against the Fongs?
Well, this is what makes the grantor's interest principle so powerful in this case. Even Justice Nakayama, despite disagreeing about the ambiguity, acknowledged that Fogarty's lack of interest in the Fong's lots at the time he imposed the restriction on the Hashimoto's was a fatal flaw.
So even if he thought the restriction was clear, he still believed Fogarty didn't have the right to create it in the first place. I'm starting to understand why this grantor's interest issue is such a big deal.
It's a core concept in property law. You can't impose a burden on someone else's property for the benefit of land you no longer have a stake in.
Right.
It would be like trying to dictate the color someone paints their house after you've already sold it.
Right. Okay, back to this privity concept you mentioned.
Okay.
How does that fit into the grantor's interest issue?
Privity is essentially a legal term that describes a close, direct relationship between parties involved in a contract or transaction.
Okay.
In property law, it often comes up when we're talking about the original parties to a deed and anyone who comes after them.
Gotcha.
Their successors in interest.
So in our case, Fogarty and the original buyers of each lot would have had privity with each other.
Exactly. They were the ones who struck the initial deal, the agreement laid out in the deed. But for a restriction like this height limitation to be enforceable as an equitable servitude, that chain of privity needs to extend beyond just those original parties.
Meaning there needs to be a legal connection between the person trying to enforce the restriction and the person who's supposed to abide by it.
Exactly. And that's where the Fong's argument falls apart. Because Fogarty sold their lots before selling the lot with the restriction to the Hashimoto's, that crucial chain of privity was broken.
So because Fogarty wasn't part of the deal anymore when the Hashimoto's bought their lot, there's no legal link between the Fongs and the Hashimoto's regarding that specific restriction.
Precisely. It's like they're trying to enforce a rule from a game they weren't even playing. And without that privity, the court made it clear they couldn't enforce the restriction, even if it had been perfectly clear and unambiguous, which, as we've seen, was a point of debate among the judges.
Wow. This case is like a legal thriller, full of twists and turns.
Right.
It really shows how important it is to understand the intricacies of property law.
It really does. And what's particularly interesting is that this case has implications that reach far beyond just this one dispute in Hawaii. The principles at play here.
Yeah.
Ambiguity, common schemes, grantor's interest, privity, these are all fundamental concepts that apply to property law in a much broader sense.
So you're telling me what happened with these Ocean View lots in Hawaii could be relevant to someone buying a condo in Chicago or dealing with their homeowners association in a suburb somewhere?
Absolutely.
It's all connected.
Absolutely. And that's what we'll explore in the final part of our deep dive. We'll take the lessons from Fong v. Hashimoto and see how they apply to other areas of property law, like HOAs and zoning regulations.
Okay, so welcome back to the final part of our deep dive into Fong v. Hashimoto.
Yeah.
We've been dissecting this Hawaiian property law case, and it's amazing how much we've uncovered from what seemed like a pretty simple dispute over a height restriction.
It really shows how these, like, straightforward property issues can become incredibly complex when you start peeling back the layers of the legal principles.
We've talked about ambiguous language.
Yes.
The importance of common schemes.
Right.
And how crucial that grantor's interest and privity are.
Absolutely.
But you mentioned that this case has broader implications.
Yes.
Like, it could even be relevant to those of us who don't live on a beautiful Hawaiian island.
Absolutely. The principles we've discussed aren't confined to this one case. They impact homeowners associations.
Oh.
Zoning regulations.
Wow.
Even those neighborhood covenants that might seem mundane at first glance.
Okay. You've definitely got my attention.
Yeah.
Let's talk about HOAs. Those havens of community rules and regulations.
Okay.
How does Fong v. Hashimoto apply to those?
Imagine an HOA trying to enforce a rule about something like fence heights or what color you can paint your front door.
Okay.
Fong v. Hashimoto tells us those rules need to be crystal clear in their wording and applied consistently to everyone in the community.
So if an HOA tries to get away with a vague rule or enforces it selectively,
right,
they could be setting themselves up for a legal challenge.
Precisely. This case reminds us that even those community associations with seemingly vast power over our lives are bound by the principles of clarity, fairness, and consistency. And remember, the grantor's interest.
Yeah.
That concept is relevant here, too.
So you're saying that whoever established the HOA, or maybe even a developer who set up initial restrictions, can't just impose new rules willy-nilly after they've moved on.
That's a great way to put it. Their ability to control what happens with the property diminishes as their interest in that property diminishes. It reinforces the idea that property rights come with responsibilities, and those responsibilities need to be clearly defined and fairly applied.
Okay, I'm starting to see how these seemingly distant legal concepts have real-world consequences.
Right.
What about zoning regulations? Those are set by local governments, not individual developers or HOAs.
Right, that's right. Zoning laws operate on a different level, but the core principles from Fong v. Hashimoto still resonate. The case emphasizes how crucial it is to have clear and consistent rules regarding land use, whether it's a deed restriction, an HOA rule, or a citywide zoning ordinance.
So it's all about making sure those rules are well-defined, easy to understand, and applied fairly across the board.
Exactly.
Whether it's a few neighbors or an entire city.
Exactly. It's about ensuring that the exercise of property rights, whether by individuals, communities, or governments, is grounded in clarity and predictability. That's how you balance individual freedoms with the needs of the community as a whole.
It's amazing how a case about a one-story house in Hawaii can give us insights into how we think about property rights and community living on a much larger scale.
It really highlights how interconnected these concepts are. And here's a final thought-provoking question for our listeners.
Right.
Imagine a scenario like Fong v. Hashimoto, but this time Fogarty includes a clause in all the original deeds saying he reserves the right to impose future restrictions. Would that change things?
Wow, that's a good one. Would that reserved right give him the ongoing interest he needed to create enforceable restrictions even after selling those lots?
It's a complex question that touches on the limits of property rights and the nature of contractual obligations. It's something for our listeners to ponder as they continue their legal journeys.
This deep dive into Fong v. Hashimoto has been a real eye-opener. We've gone from a simple phrase like one story to exploring the very foundations of property law and how it shapes the way we live together.
We've seen how seemingly minor details can have major consequences and how the principles at play in this case extend far beyond the specifics of this one dispute.
We hope this deep dive has sparked your curiosity about the intricacies of property law.
Yeah.
Be sure to check out the show notes for a link to the full case opinion, some practical tips for drafting clear and enforceable covenants.
Oh, yeah.
And even a fun quiz to test your knowledge.
And until next time, remember, the world of property law is full of fascinating twists and turns. Keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll catch you on our next deep dive.